And as we have been doing for your workshop discussions, first, what do people mean by conscience when they invoke it against lawful authority in the church? What do people mean by conscience when they invoke it against lawful authority in the church? Second, what relationship is there between political authority in Europe and the European crisis of obedience? What relationship is there between political authority in Europe and the crisis of obedience in Europe, or the European crisis? Question three is the same. What relationship is there between political democracy in America and the American crisis of obedience? In other words, the concepts of political authority or its exercise in Europe, then in America, and the crisis of obedience. Fourth, what is the basic difference between authority in the Catholic Church and authority in any other society? What is the basic difference between authority in the Catholic Church and authority in any other society? Fifth, what relationship is there between home conditions and the current attitude toward authority in the church? What relationship is there between home conditions and the current attitude toward authority in the church? Sixth and finally, what are some practical guidelines for teaching obedience to the church to Catholic students today? What are some practical guidelines for teaching obedience to Catholic students today? We want to address ourselves then to the subject, a panoramic one, of the crisis of authority. Even the attempt to talk about authority these days seems foolhardy. There is so much being said and written on the subject, and so much emotion with which it is charged. At the risk of trying the impossible, I would like to present three aspects of authority in the church today that hopefully will be of value in religious education. As usual, I would like to state each of these aspects in the form of a question. First, what is the ideology behind the widespread ecclesial disobedience in the Catholic Church? Second, in what sense should authority in the church be identified with service? And third, how is obedience to lawfully constituted authority the condition for certitude and peace? First, then, something about the ideology behind ecclesial disobedience. Here I would like to isolate and list, and if you don't mind, as we have been doing, count as I go along, some of the favorite reasons given for what is objectively disobedience, but subjectively is explained or defended on theological, sociological, or psychological grounds as, I quote, enlightened obedience. I will not, for obvious reasons, do any more than state some of the ideological reasons given for what is objectively ecclesial disobedience. Obviously, I do not subscribe to these reasons. First, development of society. Consequently, it is held, the whole concept of social behavior in the church must be revised to be contemporaneous. The church must keep up with a development in society. A second reason, the development of human personality. There has been, it is said, a phenomenal growth in the concept of person, of the individual, and especially of man's individual freedom. People are finally becoming adults. We are graduating from an infantile to a mature human race. A third reason, the growth of knowledge and education. People now know more, so they cannot merely be told what to do. They are sophisticated, so they must know the reasons why. And they are often superior in mind and training to the priests and hierarchy, so they must be treated accordingly. Now, a number of subsidiary reasons. Thus, the knowledge of psychology militates against precepts and norms. In other words, psychology shows us that people just don't like precepts and norms. Scholarship in history shows up what it is claimed we have been hiding from the people, the church's mistakes and errors in the past. Scholarship in social sciences shows that motivation, not authority, is the main factor in human behavior. Scholarship in behavioral sciences shows that people are mainly the products of heredity and environment. Hence, rewards and punishments are irrelevant in our age. Number 8 in my lineup. The whole of the cosmos is in the state of process. There is evolution in everything, including man, society, and morals. There should therefore be also a corresponding evolution in the church. There is no realism in depending on the past. For example, on the church's dogmas or precepts for the unpredictable future. Ninth, within the church itself, real authority comes from below, from the people of God. Tenth, the primacy of the Holy See must now be corrected by collegiality. Eleventh, authority now should be replaced by coordination and supervision. Superiors are a thing of the past. Twelfth, like any large organization, the church cannot be expected not to make serious mistakes. The Pope's advisors are fallible men. As a consequence, they have made mistakes. They are making mistakes now. Twelfth, still correlative with the previous one, papal infallibility is mythological. You find it only in books. History shows the popes have made many mistakes, so they cannot be trusted not to make others. 13. There are two kinds of magisterium. The authentic, which is fallible, and the definitive, which at least theoretically may be called infallible. Only solemnly defined doctrines can even remotely be considered infallible. 14. Christian dogmas must all be re-examined, even though defined, and demythologized, as we have done for the Bible, we must now do for the Church's teaching. Demythologized from their philosophical, historical, polemical, and psychological contexts. 15, and a big one. Each person's conscience is not only a practical guide, but the final arbiter in matters of faith and morals. The human conscience is not only judgmental for the here and now, it is the normative, each person's, for himself, even to pass judgment on faith and morality. 16. Complete certitude is impossible, even in matters of faith. 17. Permanent commitment to any way of life is contrary to the known changes in people and to a reasonable expectancy of grace from God. 18. The social and cultural needs of humanity must take precedence over the cultic practices of the Church. The Church must leave the sacristy to go into the marketplace. 19. The Church as an institution is anachronistic, stifles the free aspirations of its members, and as institution is a human development. Christ started a way of life. He did not found an institutional society. 20. In the Church, the charismatic inspiration of the people is above the hierarchical authority of the Pope and bishops. 21. Four more to go. In the Church, the scholarly insights of theologians are equal to and may be superior to the hierarchical magisterium. 22. Unless the Church adjusts to the times, it cannot survive. Either accommodation or extinction for the Church as a whole, or any segment of the same. 23. Everything is in the process of radical change. So too must be laws, natural and psychological, moral and spiritual. To change is to live. To stop changing is to die. 24th, and last. The circumstances of place, time, and culture are too different among peoples and in different periods of history for the church ever to legislate for all people or all time. Only God can do that. The church's unique role is not to legislate, but only to exhort, counsel, and encourage. By way of a brief commentary on the 24 samples of ideology, I wish to say they are all, either verbatim or equivalently, in Catholic writers in Europe and America today. So much for the background, which I think is important before we undertake what is the real purpose of what I want to share with you this morning, to speak on authority. The second dimension, therefore, to which we want to address ourselves is the equation between authority and service. Few terms are more commonly used nowadays in connection with authority than the word service. Rightly understood, this juxtaposition can be very enlightening. Misapplied, it can lead to some disastrous consequences. For this, the second level of our analysis, I want to cover three things. To briefly see the misuse of the term, which is being used to shore up the idea of authority from the people to the church. Then, to take a look at what the New Testament says on service, and then to clarify the church's vision in the future as service. First, then, something about the misuse of service in terms of authority. One of the pities of any tragedy, the only tragic thing about tragedies, is that what happens to the victim is often not due to malice or ill will, but to human error or misjudgment. In the past week, we've already seen enough on the subject to say that there are ideologues still calling themselves Catholic who are saying that the church's authority derives not from the top down, but from the bottom up. The people, democratically, deliberate and decide on what they want. Then their duly appointed representatives, call them coordinators, implement what the people decide. Given this inverted concept of the church's structure, those in authority clearly are at the service of those nominally under authority, Pope, bishops, and superiors, become simply delegates of the faithful. That's one side. At the same time, in other quarters, there is a growing desire to recover the Spirit of Christ for those in authority, that they should govern the church with humility and kindness, and be genuinely concerned for the welfare of their individual subjects. In this sense, they are literally at the service of others, even as they govern them. The two attitudes, unfortunately, have become confused in people's minds, and the results are a matter of tragic record. The legitimate desire to have superiors exercise their authority in Christ-like fashion, even as he, the Master, served the needs of his followers, what a paradox. The Master serving. Is obscured, this legitimate desire is obscured by the illegitimate desire to subvert the authority of superiors by making them serve the whims and caprice of others. What is the New Testament teaching on service? It is no exaggeration to say that the idea of service is at the heart of God's revelation. Its importance is seen from the negation of service, which brought about the fall of the angels, whose leader said, "Non serviam," I will not serve. Already in the Old Testament, the Messiah was foretold as being one who would be the suffering servant, the servant of Yahweh. Christ himself said of himself that he is the